Okay, so today we will be continuing our study of the Satipatthana Sutta. Yesterday we finished with the Sampajanapabha, and now we come to the Partikula Manasikara Pabha. Pamba, which is the section on the contemplation of repulsiveness, Patikula Manasikara. And what we can see from this sutta, if we take a sort of an innocent stance on this sutta, is that there are many sorts of practice that we can undertake for the purpose of coming to understand the body, for example. For the purpose of coming to understand reality in general. And this is already mostly understood in terms of some people practicing samatha meditation, some people practicing vipassana meditation. But this sutta, if we take a innocent view of it, then we can see that the Buddha is pointing out the a sort of a comprehensive list of these various practices that one might undertake to to come closer to understanding reality. And why I say an innocent view is because some people take this sutta to be a later creation where the Buddha brought together many, the compilers brought together many of the teachings of the Buddha into one teaching, because they think it's maybe ridiculous to put all of these teachings together. But for the purposes of this study group in general, just to be clear, we're taking a fairly innocent view. And I think that's a good way of putting it, rather than saying orthodox or so on. But we're taking it at face value, unless something comes up. We start at face value, and then if something really strange comes up that can't be easily understood or explained, then we try to find a reason. So maybe we end up having some suspicion later on. But we're going to start by thinking, well, this is something that the Buddha actually taught, unless we come to some passage that makes us seriously question this. And I don't think there's anything worth questioning in this regard at all. It's very easy to understand how the Buddha may have taught all of these together, because it carries out in practice. And it carries out in practice of a single meditator. The practice of all of these can be undertaken by a single meditator. Or one might pick and choose. So even if we're to take this as to be a comprehensive teaching for a single meditator, all of these practices can be undertaken at one time or another. And one can pick and choose and can tweak, actually, all of these, you know, tweak the amount that one, and the role that each of these meditations play in one's overall practice. But another thing we have to keep in mind with this sutta, and really the suttas in general, is that the Buddha would often be teaching to quite a large audience. And if we look up at the top of this, we can we know that the Buddha was dwelling in near a market town, and he was with the bhikkhus. And what we hear from the commentary is that actually the bhikkhus here were not the only ones in the audience. That the reason he taught the Satipatthana Sutta in this place is because the kurus were, in general, naturally inclined towards mindfulness. So it's clear that this was probably quite a large audience coming together. This was all the people who were at be practicing mindfulness during their work and so on. Even those people who would be practicing just mindfulness in daily life and so on. And so the point is that not every meditator is the same, and not every meditator will use all of these meditation techniques. Not every meditator will use them all in the same amounts. And so it's quite dogmatic to think that what is being said in this sutta is that one meditator should practice all of these. I've even heard people say that these should be practiced in order. That the grammar here, and obviously the grammar really doesn't support it, but if one were to take the punaccha parang literally, which of course one shouldn't, then one might think that and then the monk should practice this way. So it means start with anapanasati, and then after that practice the iriyapata, and then practice sampajanya, and then practice this and so on. Until finally you're practicing Dhamma Anupassana, all the way at the end. This sort of interpretation, or the interpretation that all of these practices should be treated separately and can't be practiced in harmony with each other, is, I think, overly dogmatic. And it arises quite, it's a common thing for meditators to give rise to this sort of idea that, for example, their teacher teaches a specific meditation, so they come to think, well, that's all you need is only that meditation, and you don't ever need to practice these other meditations. So, I mean, we fall into that quite often. We have meditators just do vipassana meditation and we don't pay attention to the other meditations. But the reason for the teacher doing that is often because that's what the teacher himself or herself practiced successfully and knows. And so that they're not trying to say that these other practices are useless or unbeneficial. It's just that they understand that this is of benefit and essential. For instance, people who teach Anapanasati will say that that's essential. People who practice mindfulness of the elements will say that that's essential. And we'll leave it up to the meditators to fill in the gaps or in their daily life to study and to contemplate these other sorts of meditation. So even if we're taking the sort of meditation that we practice in my tradition as our main meditation practice, so watching the meat and potatoes or the core of this sutta, which is to watch the body, the feelings, the mind, and the Dhamma in sort of a mundane sense or an absolute sense, in terms of absolute reality. So when you move, knowing the movement, and when you feel pain, knowing the pain, and so on. It doesn't mean that we can't practice this sort of meditation that's coming up next. And in fact, this next sort of meditation can be quite useful, even if we're not taking it as our main meditation. Patikula Manasikara is actually considered one of the four Arakkhakammatthana, the meditations that we should, that we use to guard ourselves or to protect our main meditation. And it's mainly useful for people who have a great deal of lust inside of them. And it can be used in two ways. If you're practicing this meditation in terms of as your main meditation, then in the beginning all it does is repress the feelings. It doesn't help you to understand them. When you just recite these 32 parts of the body, kesa, loma, nakha, danta, tajjo, mangsang, and so on, and when you focus on them, or pick one that's really clear and just focus on it, in the beginning it merely represses them. But once you start to start to see the reality behind them, you know, and start to see your lust in regards to them, then it becomes a practice for vipassana. Actually, the commentary says that this practice can lead all the way up to arahantship, the practice, and this is borne out in the suttas as well. So for someone who practices the mindfulness of these things, well, the one way of practicing it is to just do a recitation and to fix your mind on one of the objects. But the vipassana practice is to then take these and to focus and look at the mind that is attracted to them, the mind that is repulsed by them, and to look at what's the experience of these things, the experience of the body, based on these things, and based on the clarity that has come from the tranquility. The point of using this sort of meditation is to develop a level of tranquility and peace of mind, because this sort of peace of mind is disturbed by lust, by our lust and delusion, the delusion which leads to the lust, the delusion that the body is something beautiful or something handsome or something attractive. Many people take issue with this sort of teaching and say that, well, it's actually not true that the body is disgusting. The body is just the body. It's neither beautiful nor disgusting. And people have if they've developed this sort of view that the body is something to be respected, and they want to have this, people have this idea that we shouldn't see the body as disgusting because that will lead to low self-esteem, then they think that developing this will actually be harmful. And I think in some people it could be harmful. If they're the sort of person who has a lot of self-hatred or so on, then they certainly shouldn't practice this sort of meditation. But if it's a person with a lot of lust or attachment to the body, then it's useful to practice. And furthermore, it's most likely quite rare to find someone who is attached to the idea that the body is loathsome. If a person is attached to the idea that the body is loathsome or in some unbeneficial way, then they wouldn't most likely be born as a human being. The reason we're born as human beings is because we find this form attractive. We've gotten used to it as a source of pleasure and enjoyment, and so we come back. We come to be born in this state. And so really for ordinary people in general, this is quite a valid meditation and a useful meditation, because it helps to not create repulsion in the mind, but to create a wisdom in the mind, really, to dispel this delusion that somehow there's something beautiful about the body. And the Visuddhimagga, the path of purification, does this quite nicely. So I thought in regards to this one, I would just give a sample of what the path of purification has to say about this. It goes into quite some detail, and the commentary to the sutta, I think, does as well, about how one should develop mindfulness, patigula manasikara, which is also called Gaya Gattasati, mindfulness that has gone to the body. It says that you'll do them forwards and backwards. Means you really will chant these. You do Kesa Lomanak, and then you'll do them in groups, and you'll do them based on which is clearest and so on. I don't think it's so useful to go into detail about the method. We just understand that in general it's a recitation meditation where you focus on one at a time, or you focus on five at a time, and you contemplate them. So you're thinking, when you say Kesa, you're thinking of the head hair. When you say Loma, you're thinking of hair of the body. Nakha, you're thinking of the nails. Danta, you're thinking of the teeth, and you actually focus on this part of the body. And so the Visuddhimagga actually recommends plucking out one or two head hairs and placing them in one's hand. Then you look at them and you come to see what hair is like. And so you use that as a meditation object, which is maybe a good way to start the practice. But what I wanted to focus more on than the actual technique, because I think anyone who is interested in practicing this can go into detail in using the Visuddhimagga quite easily, you know, following the meditation practice, following the technique in there. But just to give basic theory, I thought it'd be interesting to talk about why these things are considered to be loathsome, and why one might have to admit that they're loathsome. And as I said, the Visuddhimagga does a good job of this by explaining in, I think, quite objective terms, not subjective at all. So it talks about head hairs. Firstly, head hairs are black in their normal color, the color of fresh arnika seeds, whatever those are. As to shape, they are the shape of long, round measuring rods. As to direction, they lie in the upper direction. As to location, their location is the wet inner skin that envelops the skull. It is bounded on both sides by the roots of the ears, in front by the forehead, and behind the nape of the neck, and behind by the nape of the neck. As to delimitation, they are bounded below by the surface of their own roots, which are fixed by entering to the amount of the tip of a rice grain into the inner skin that envelops the head. They are bounded above by space and all around by each other. There are no two hairs together. This is their delimitation by the similar. Head hairs are not body hairs, and body hairs are not head hairs, being likewise not intermixed with the remaining 31 parts. The head hairs are a separate part. This is their delimitation by the dissimilar. The Visuddhimagga is answering questions here, like, what is its color? What is its... It's got classifications for each part. So for each part, it's going to answer, what is its color? What is its location? What is its delimitation in terms of what is its limit or its boundary and so on. Their definition as to repulsiveness in the five ways, that is, by color, etc., is as follows. Head hairs are repulsive in color as well as in shape, odor, habitat, and location. For on seeing the color of a head hair in a bowl of inviting rice gruel or cooked rice, people are disgusted and say, this has got hairs in it, take it away. So they are repulsive in color. Also, when people are eating at night, they are likewise disgusted by the mere sensation of a hair-shaped akka bark or makachi bark fiber. So they are repulsive in shape. It's the akka bark or makachi bark, some kind of food that even when you think that you're eating hair and you're not eating hair, you feel disgusted. If you had a bowl of rice that someone dumped a bunch of hair in, one hair is maybe not so bad, but what if the waitress with long hair or waiter with long hair stuck their hair in you know, the tip of their head hair was getting into your food. How would you feel about that? Most people would be quite disgusted. When you break it up like this, you come to see the nature. But the commentary is actually willing to accept that hair might be beautiful. As you see in a second. As to the odor of head hairs, unless dressed with a smearing of oil scented with flowers, etc., is most offensive, and it is still worse when they are put in the fire. So, trying to make us imagine burnt hair, which is quite smelly, actually. And then it says, even if head hairs are not directly repulsive in color and shape, some people might argue, still their odor is directly repulsive, just as a baby's excrement. As to its color is the color of turmeric, and as to its shape is the shape of a piece of turmeric root. Turmeric is this Indian spice that they use to make curry. And just as the bloated carcass of a black dog thrown on a rubbish heap, as to its color is the color of a ripe palmyra fruit, and as to its shape is the shape of a drum left face down, and its fangs are like jasmine buds. And so even if both these are not directly repulsive in color and shape, still their odor is directly repulsive. So too, if head hairs are not directly repulsive in color and shape, still their odor is directly repulsive. And as to habitat, just as pot herbs that grow on village sewage in a filthy place are disgusting to civilized people and unusable. There are places in the world where they grow vegetables and so on using human excrement. Apparently, in Thailand, this monk was telling us that in Thailand in old times there was this guy who was growing really big and wonderful vegetables on human feces. But it says most people would find that disgusting and civilized people would find it unusable. Why? Because of its habitat. Even the vegetables are beautiful still. They wouldn't eat them thinking this is coming from human feces. So also head hairs are disgusting since they grow on the sewage of pus, blood, urine, dung, bile, phlegm, and the like. So where do the hair grow? They grow in the skull, in amongst the blood and the blood. Well, just the blood, basically, blood and flesh and hair, scalp, and so on. And these head hairs grow on the heap of the other 31 parts as fungus do on a dunghill. And owing to the filthy place they grow in, they are quite as unappetizing as vegetables growing on a charnel ground, on a midden, etc., as lotuses or water lilies growing in drains, and so on. The drains in India in ancient times. This is the repulsive aspect of their location. And so on. And then it goes on to define the rest of them. If you're interested in this, this what I just quoted starts on page 224 of my text. And I'm not sure if that's the actual 224 or not. But section 83 of the chapter... I don't know which chapter it is. Mindfulness occupied with the body. So, but you get the point. It's quite an eye-opener to read all of that, because it's not something we would have ever thought of. We may intellectually think agree when we hear this and think about it and say, okay, I can understand the body could be seen to be disgusting, but it's really a shock when you actually look at it. And you come to see how steeped in delusion we actually are. That we could actually think that this is somehow beautiful. And it sounds kind of unpleasant to hear this sort of thing. Our delusion is so deep that we actually take issue with the idea that the body might be repulsive. We find it offensive for people to suggest such a thing. We think this sort of teaching must be an evil teaching, a bad teaching. It's to that extent. And yet all we have to do is objectively do as the Buddha is showing us to do here and say to ourselves, Ke sa lo ma, or in English as you understand it. And you'll come to see that, well, they didn't leave anything out, anything of any importance out of this list of 32. And going through them back and forth and splitting them into groups and examining each of these objectively. Do it objectively, that's fine. And look at the Visuddhimagga, and if you disagree with it, you can be more objective than it, but I think it's quite objective in its explanation of all of these parts. And then come back and see. And I think it's quite easy to realize through this practice that the body is actually... As Sariputta, I believe, was the one who said that he regards this body like a dog carcass hanging around the neck, as though just as some young person, man or woman, who is fond of their body and so on, fond of scents and clean clothes, would decorate them all up. And then put hang a dog corpse around their neck. So that's how he looks at his body. He was using it to explain, to counter the accusation that he had hit someone. This monk didn't like Sariputta for, I can't remember the reason, but it's probably one of you can remember it. You remember the reason why Sariputta? He what? Yeah, this monk, yeah, then that's right. That's the lion's, Sariputta's lion's roar. This monk, what happened is Sariputta, he didn't like Sariputta for whatever reason, so Sariputta once was walking by him, and the corner of his robe touched this monk, and he went around saying that Sariputta had struck him. And so the Buddha called Sariputta up and asked him, so is it true, Sariputta, did you intentionally strike this monk? And the Buddha gave his lion's roar. Anyway, only related to this tangentially in terms of how we should see the body or how we come to see the body. This isn't dogma that we have to accept on faith, but by doing this sort of practice, or by even practicing ordinary vipassana, one comes to ordinary satipatthana, one comes to see this truth. And it can actually be it can actually be dangerous if you focus on this meditation too much. As I said, there's a story of these monks who practiced this and then got so repulsed that they decided to kill themselves, and they hired someone to kill them, like this group of 30 monks, and they had this guy kill them. And so the commentary says that, well, the Buddha knew that this was going to happen, but he didn't really have any choice because these guys had been deer hunters in past lives and were destined to die in a horrible way anyway. But he figured the best he could do for them is give them some focus and concentration so that they wouldn't have to come back to be born as humans. And indeed, they were, somehow they benefited from it. But after that, the Buddha said, well, practice anapanasati is maybe more of benefit. But he didn't apologize for it, for having taught them kaya gata sati. And I don't think, looking at it innocently, I don't think he has to apologize, because we can understand that it was their karma that was leading them to it and not the Buddha's instruction. But anyway, point being, you do have to be careful. In general, you have to be careful with samatha practice, with practice that is dealing with concepts, because if your mind is unstable, you'll go beyond the established concept. I mean, if you think about any concept, then you understand that they're subjective. We have 32 parts of the body, but you could just as easily imagine a being with 33 parts. That's a good question. Doesn't the commentary have? Doesn't the commentary you said have 33? Yeah. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10. I missed it. How many are there?
There's 32 there.
You count them?
Yeah.
And 33rd is the brain, huh? Matta kang matta lungkanti. The last one is matta lungkang, which is the brain and the skull. I guess there are 33. It's an interesting question, because and one that I wanted to count, because our Indology teacher explained it to us, and I didn't want to agree with her, but she may be right, is that people of that time, I don't really know that I could agree with it, but she's a very famous Indologist. And, she's a horrible, very hard to deal with person. Not a very good professor, but very knowledgeable. She said it's because in those times, they didn't even know that the brain existed. It's an odd answer, odd explanation, isn't it? That they didn't understand, they didn't know about the brain, because they would never cut apart bodies. They would never cut. They would never break open the skull. They would always burn the bodies. And we could at least understand that that would be the reason why the Buddha wouldn't mention it, because it wouldn't be that common. That's how we could understand this, is that, yes, people did know about the brain, but wasn't very common, and people had never really seen it, and, you know, they obviously didn't have these biology books, that picture books that show you what the brain looks like. So it wasn't something that anyone had ever seen or would see. Would see in general. Now, the reason I have a bit of a problem with that is because we're taught that in ancient India, the last thing they would do when they were burning the body is smash open the skull of the dead person. It was actually became a ritual, because you want the whole body to burn evenly. So they actually have a smashing open of the skull, in which case you would expect that they would see the brain. I believe in the Visuddhimagga it has the... Here we are. It has the... It has the brain. Okay, here's interesting. The brain being included in the bone marrow in this version, with a total of only 31 aspects. Now, why are we getting only Dawating? Parts. No, see, without the brain, it's only 31 parts. Am I wrong about this? Let's see. Let's count them again. I just did the Pali, no? Because it's easy. Kesa loma naka danta tajo mangsang naharu ati ati minjang wakang hadayang yakanang gilomakang pihakang papasang antang antang gunang udariang karisang pitang semang pubo lohitang sedo medo asuwasa kelo singkanika lasika Muta. Was that 31? Or 32? Oh boy. Kesalo manaka danta tajo mangsang naharu ati ati minjang wakang handayang nakanang gilomakang pihakang papasang antang antagunang udariang karisang pitang semang pubolo hitang sedo medo asu wasa kelo singkanika lasika mutang. That's 32, no? Well, I have to find an answer on that one. But with the commentary, what the Path of Purification says is that the one without the brain is just including it in marrow, bone marrow. The commentary says that the brain is included in the Atiminjang, the bone marrow, because technically the brain is something inside the bones, right? It's inside the skull. But the idea in ancient India was that the mind was in the heart, so the brain was just like some big useless fatty thing. Maybe it's because people didn't think so much back then as well. I just kind of sat around and meditated. Didn't use computers. Didn't have to figure out why their internet connection wasn't working. So they didn't use the brain quite as much as we use it today. It's quite possible as well. Maybe back then they didn't even have brains, and it's something that's just appeared. No, because we have fossil evidence, no? Probably there were brains back then. Well, you have to examine all possibilities. It's quite likely they did have brains, but as my Indology teacher said, they didn't know they existed. And so it would have been unfamiliar to most people at the very least, and that's why they don't mention it. But you could easily put the brain in here and ask yourself whether the brain was exempt from all this. Some people think the brain is quite amazing, no? And they think the body in general, biologists who study DNA and RNA and so and genes and so on, they think how wonderful it is. But this is a subjectivity. If one is objective about the body, even about genes and DNA and so on, one can see how, you know, the only reason that biologists say humans evolved is by mistake. You know, when it's when DNA copying makes a mistake that we develop, that there is evolution, because sometimes the mistakes work better than the original, if they copy incorrectly. But the point being that it's all just a big mess. It's not a machine that works perfectly. It's something that is all messed up. I mean, look at the genes, how genes work. Some people become mentally handicapped as a result of their genes, or their growth is stunted as a result of their genes, or they have a chemical imbalance in the brain as a result of their genes, and so on. There was an interesting article that I was reading about how, on psilocybin, this drug. You were in, you didn't, Nagasena didn't hear it either. They did this study on people using psilocybin, injecting them with psilocybin, the active ingredient in magic mushrooms. And what they expected to find, or what anyone would have expected them to find, is that it increases brain activity, stimulates certain brain activities that cause you to hallucinate. It's actually the opposite, according to this study. Actually, psilocybin inhibits brain activity, stops the brain from working. Not completely, but to a certain extent inhibits the brain's ability to work. And so the conclusion or the hypothesis of the experiment is that actually the brain serves not as a not as the initiation of thought, but as a filter for thought, which was a theory that was advanced by the great, I don't know what you'd call him, Dr. What's his name? Henry James? William James? James was his last name. James. William James? Henry James? Can't remember. But this this guy who forgot the other guy's name, but this book, Irreducible Mind, talks all about this. William James was his name, and the other one was forgot his name as well. If you read the book Irreducible Mind, it's a huge book, very hard to read, but very interesting. Talks about this new idea that they had in the early 20th century, early 1900s, about how the brain might not be the creator of thought, but actually just a filter. And the reason they came up with this was not because they were some kind of mystics or had some ideas that they wanted to prove, but that's what the data suggested. The only conclusion fit the facts, based on clinical studies that they were doing at the time, based on extreme cases where people had these strange experiences. And this is really it points to the, that's very tangential at this point, but the conflict between going with quantity of results as opposed to going with quality of results, because most scientists will reject these fringe subjects and reject a lot of interesting material for study of the brain because you can't quantify it. You can't pick out 1,000 people who have, you know, strange mental experiences and verify it against them all. So they consider these things to be anecdotal, because the, you know, if a scientist studies a single person, then it's anecdotal evidence. It's not a proper experiment or a proper observation. But the point they make is that this isn't science. This is what they call scientism. You know, the blind adherence to some method that can't possibly hope to bring the truth, because it's these extreme cases that stretch the borders of our understanding. And so the interesting thing about this study was that about this whole theory is that it obviously goes quite well with how we understand reality in Buddhism, that the brain doesn't create the, and it helps to answer some questions about how we relate our theory and also our practice to modern science, for example, to modern science. So we understand that what does the brain do? It's more like an office than a home of the mind. The mind comes in and does its work and uses the brain as a control room, and that's how it interacts with the body. So the point I wanted to make here is in regards to answering the question of how we can understand the brain to be somehow have negative aspects, is that actually through the meditation practice especially we come to see the brain as an incredibly negative thing. And I would be quite forceful about that observation, that the brain is an incredibly negative thing, that without the brain, our thought processes would be so much freer. And this is, I think, a revolutionary idea, but we have this backing of this wonderful YouTube video of this neurobiologist, neuroscientist, Jill, can't remember her last name. Horrible with names. Anyway, we talked about this one of the other study courses, or at some point we talked about this. It's on YouTube, very famous. This doctor has a stroke, and she describes how free the mind became and how pure the mind became at the time when half of her brain wasn't working. And then there's that UN video that we watched. What was his name? Can't remember anybody's name. Bruce Grayson. And he explains this idea of this observable phenomenon that doctors come across, that people who go brain dead, the brain isn't working, and can still and have incredible experiences and clear thought processes that shouldn't be possible without active brain functioning. If we start to appreciate this apparent truth that is not being appreciated by neurobiologists or scientists in general, then when we look at what the brain actually does, if the brain isn't creating consciousness, which would make it kind of a wonderful thing, magical thing really, then what is it really doing? We can see that actually it's keeping us in a cage, this cage of the body. It's forcing our mind activity to be limited to these six senses. And so we go around saying, this is beautiful, that's beautiful, and that's a wonderful sound. And when we could in fact be constantly living a life of bliss, it's possible that to enter into a state of mind, this neurobiologist or neuroscientist, her experience is quite incredible to listen to, where it was totally beyond any kind of partial sensual experience that we could possibly have as human beings or in an ordinary state, because it was relieved of this cage of the brain and the six senses and sensuality. Anyway, so a little bit of a tangent there was to the nature of the brain. He's certainly not leaving the brain out because it's something beautiful or wonderful. Okay, so this is a certain meditation that people practice in, and of course there's a great, very detailed explanation of how to practice it. It also happens to be the meditation practice that traditionally monks learn when they first, or novices learn when they first ordain. The idea is to give them meditation practice, and it shows that even today there's still a traditional emphasis on meditation. Even the traditional ordination routine, procedure, the first step is learning meditation. You know, well, now you're a novice, what should you do first? Learn meditation. And so this is considered to be it's called Mula Kamatana, the foundation meditation, or your first meditation. It's the one that you should take up first and use it as a general means of getting yourself to a level where you can appreciate the higher teachings of ultimate reality. Right? Because before we overcome our attachment to being human, and this is really what this meditation comes down to, is giving up the attachment to the human state, this idea that being human is somehow special or a good thing or ultimately real, like we are humans and the human race, thinking of how important it is and so on, thinking as the human race as something substantial or something real, and the human state as being a specific state that happens to be the highest state that there is, right? Because if you're a materialist, then you would look around you and say, human beings are obviously the highest, so it's the highest that exists, or the highest that there is, thinking it's somehow special. So when you practice this meditation, it helps you to see, well, what is there really is experience. The whole body is just broken, made up of component part. There's not actually anything substantial in there. You see this by giving up your attachment to it. Once you see how disgusting it is and then the mind lets go, then you're able to look at it objectively. And that's when you switch to practicing vipassana and looking at it objectively. But it, the objectivity comes about, is helped through the practice of kayagata sati or patikula sanya, patikula manasikara, as it's called, manasikara. Then the Buddha gives a simile. It's just as if one were to have a bag with two openings. And the bag has two openings. The body actually has nine openings. I'm not going to name them, but you can... I think there are places in the suttas, I can't remember, it's been a long time since I read those ones, about, is it the suttas or commentaries, the bag with nine holes? You think of this body as a bag with nine holes that is leaking and poorly sewn up. So it's splitting at the seams and gets cut and then pours out all sorts of awful things. This meditation teacher, he was talking about these people growing crops on human feces. He said, you know, we're just what we are. We're all just portable toilets. and said he called us. He said, we're portable porta potties. That's what we are. Full of urine and feces and awful stuff. So actually, we are a bag that has 9 holes, and all these 9 holes, and even through the skin, is oozing out all sorts of wonderful stuff, gold and jewels and frankincense and myrrh and sugar and spice and all things nice. It's just pouring out of these holes and oozing out of the skin, sugar and spice. Cinnamon and so on. No cinnamon. When cinnamon goes into the body, it comes out something quite different. Garlic. When garlic goes into the body, it comes out quite powerfully, actually. Milk. When milk goes into the body, it goes in pure. People actually have milk baths because they think of milk as being so pure. But after you drink it, it comes out quite different. So there's actually a meditation on the repulsiveness of food in particular. It helps you to let go of the attachment to food. If you read the Visuddhimagga, it talks about that. It's quite interesting as well to break down the process of eating and see what's really going on. It gives this simile to help us to understand how we're to do it. We're to look at the body and pick out the pieces and look at it one piece at a time. And then he repeats the stanza that we've already gone through in the other sections. Iti ajatang and so on. It's the end of that section. So we'll do the next section as well and then we'll call it quits. How are we doing? It's 9 o'clock from 7:30. That's an hour and a half, and I know we lost some time there with the reason why I hesitate is because the next one I want to talk about in terms of its place in Vipassana meditation, and it's getting a little bit on. I think we'll stop there. Let's apologies for the technical difficulties, but I think we'll stop there and come back next week to go on with the next section and hopefully finish up Gaya Sati, Gaya Nupassana next week. So, thanks everyone for coming, and hopefully we'll be able to sort out the technical difficulties before next week. Before we leave, we'll do another homage.